This is 1A. I'm Sarah McCammon. For a country ravaged by ongoing war and now by a pandemic, planning for the future might seem difficult, if not totally futile. But that's just what a group of young Syrians were doing when they built a secret library from books they spirited out of bombed buildings.
We could see it was vital to create a library in order to continue our education. To find material for the shelves, we went to abandoned buildings, collected any wood we could find, and brought it back here. In many cases, we get books too, from bomb or shell-damaged homes. Most of these places are near the front line, so collecting them is very dangerous.
That was Anas Ahmad, a former student and one of the founders of the library in Syria's town of Diraya. Joining us from London is Mike Thompson, BBC World Affairs correspondent and author of Syria's Secret Library, Reading and Redemption in a Town Under Siege. Mike, welcome to 1A.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
So how did you first stumble upon the secret library in Syria?
Well, I was looking into a story about the experience of people in Syria who were living under siege. And at that point in 2016, there was something like, amazingly, about half a million of them in 15 different locations. And I spoke to someone in Diraya, where my book is set, and I said to him, how do you cope psychologically with the stress of knowing you could be killed at any moment and you've virtually no food? And he said, well, we have a secret weapon. And I imagine some sort of massive gun under camouflage netting or something. And it turned out, he said, that our secret weapon is a library. It's our secret library. And it was from that moment on, I was so fascinated by what he told me that became almost a bigger project than all my research into the sieges.
And what was this library like inside?
Well, it was quite Spartan, although they did have carpets and they did have a couple of quite large couches and one big wooden table. And it was sort of wall-to-wall lined with books, all split into, as you'd expect in a library, into categories of the author and subject. And what most amazed me was this library was just, 5 or 6 feet beneath the streets above, where there were people being sniped at every day from almost any part of the city. Bombs were going off, shells were going off. And yet down below you had this sort of subterranean haven, this literary sanctuary, as the people called it, where life was full of people just reading, discussing literature, discussing history, holding lectures. It was just quite extraordinary, these two worlds separated by such a short amount of space.
And let me ask you what might be a really obvious question, but I think to American ears, maybe it's hard to understand. Why did this library have to be kept a secret?
Well, the fear was that something, in fact, that David Miliband mentioned just now about 85 hospitals having been bombed in Syria, that is something that the Syrian regime has done quite a lot to hospitals or anywhere really that glues society together in its effort to drive people out of places and to win this war. And the fear was in Diraya that if Assad's forces became aware of the secret library and the value it had for their community, the sort of centre, the heart of the community that it became, they'd want to destroy it. So they kept it secret, which meant there were no signs to it. It was just word of mouth that people knew where it was.
And in a moment, we'll talk more about the town of Diraya, where this library was located, and what was going on there. But first, Mike, tell us a little bit more about the library. How many books were in it, and where did they come from?
Well, there are around about 15,000 books, and all of these books had been collected from bomb-damaged houses around Diraya. People had seen them sitting there, often with buildings missing their roofs and sometimes even their walls as well. And these books were getting parched in the sun and drenched in the rain and were rotting and decaying. And most of the people who built the library and created it were former students, and they loved books, and they couldn't bear to see this happening. And one of them said to me, you know, we realized we couldn't really save ourselves other than just hoping for the best and staying in basements as much as possible, but we could save these books. And the first initial plan was to gather them, put them in boxes and keep them safe, until someone said, rather than leave them in boxes, why don't we put them somewhere people can read them? And a voice at the back of this group apparently shouted out, "A library!" And they said, "Yes, that's it, a library. That's what we'll do."
An underground library. We'll talk more about it in just a moment. We're speaking with Mike Thompson, author of Syria's Secret Library, Reading and Redemption in a Town Under Siege. We'll have more from Mike in just a moment. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as isolation, depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment when you need professional help. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit betterhelp.com/1A to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or perfect strangers? Get the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
There's a lot going on in the world right now. You ever just feel like you want to talk it all out? Well, I'm here to help. My name is Sam Sanders. I host NPR's It's Been a Minute. Each week on my show, a bunch of smart guests and I talk about the news and the culture without making you feel overwhelmed. Join us every Friday on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
In a Syrian town, a group of residents found respite in a secret library hidden from the violence of the country's civil war. We're speaking with Mike Thompson, author of Syria's Secret Library, Reading and Redemption in a Town Under Siege, about the young Syrians who risked their lives for their love of books. And Mike, before we talk about the young Syrians who invested so much in this library, I want to talk about the town of Diraya, where the library was located. Paint us a picture, if you would, of what it was like before the war.
Well, it's a fairly small town, small sort of semi-urban town on the doorstep of Damascus, just to the southwest. And it's a place where I was told everybody knows everyone else just about. There were about 80,000 people living there, but by about 2012, that had gone down to 8,000 when the siege got underway. But before the war, it was a place with a very vibrant agricultural community. It had a big industry in making furniture, a lot of furniture shops, and a very popular local football stadium, that's soccer football, and a number of cafes, and the place most people loved to go was an ice cream parlour there, which made all sorts of exotic ice creams. But it was a very friendly place, somewhere where people who couldn't afford to live in Damascus when they worked there would live in Diraya, quite a close-knit community.
And how did the war change all that?
Well, the town had a long history of peaceful protest. Over the decades, the people had mounted many protests against the government, and in fact, the father of the current president against his government. And they took part, many of them, in the demonstrations of 2011. This became such a sore in the side of the government that in 2012 they sent troops into Diraya. And at this point, there had been much less actual violence, just more sort of protest. But they'd been in 2012 getting more and more, there'd been more and more violence. And the troops came in, and there were varying accounts as to how many people died, but somewhere between 200 and 800 people were killed. According to locals there, they say people were often dragged out of their house and slaughtered. This, of course, denied by the government, which claims it was extremists within the town that did that. And after that, of course, there was utter terror in the place. When the army was forced to withdraw, all those who hadn't left but had been thinking of it pulled out, and it left around 8,000 people, largely young men, but also quite a few young women, and indeed quite a few children.
And Mike, I know you had to do a lot of your reporting about the secret library remotely, you know, over the internet, but you spent time in Diraya, right? When were you there? For how long?
I couldn't get in there. I tried twice to get in there following my discussion with the guy that I was talking to via social media. But of course, there was a siege. So once the siege got underway, I couldn't get in. And that was an enormous frustration. And in fact, at one point, they were planning to smuggle me in, or two people I'd been talking to try and smuggle me into the town. And two of the main people in the book, Abdul Basit and Anas, and Anas, you played a clip from earlier. When I said I was going to try and do this, they said, look, this is incredibly dangerous. Don't risk it. We've spent a long time talking to you about what's been happening in our town. We want this book to happen. And if you come here, it probably won't.
You met a number of mostly young Syrians from Diraya who found refuge in this secret library we're talking about. And one of them was a 14-year-old named Amjad.
I tried to memorize every one. There were so many good books that I kept skipping from one to another. Then I said to the men in charge, I want to stay here.
14-year-old Amjad lives with his family beneath a bombed building next door to the secret library. He only knew it existed after being told to take shelter there during some shelling.
It was a real surprise. When I first walked into the library, it was really exciting. There were so many books, some on top shelves, that I couldn't reach. This library is very important for my education. For example, my reading skills have improved so much, and now I know lots of things that I didn't before.
And he's such a compelling character in your story, Mike. Tell us about Amjad. How did you first connect with him?
Well, it was quite extraordinary. I rang the library, and normally you couldn't get through because it was underground, so there was no internet signal in most of it. But I managed to get through to 14-year-old Amjad, who was very near. He was on a ladder quite near the ceiling, so probably better access to a signal. And he had Abdul Basit's phone. That's the one of the guys who ran the library. And so when I rang and asked for him, he said, no, this is not Abdul Basit, this is Amjad. And I could hear this little voice. He sounded like he was about 9. In fact, you know, he was 14, but he sounded very young. And I said, look, would you mind very much? Great speaking to you, but can I speak to the man in charge? And he said, I am in charge. I even have my own office. And I said, as a sort of an aside, I said to him, "What do you have your name on the door?" Because he said he was the chief librarian. I said, "Do you have your name on the door?" And he said, "Actually, yes, I do. And I even have a desk in my office, and it's small, just like me." And his humour and his vibrance and his absolute love of books, the way he talked about trying to remember every single book when he got down into the library and tried to read as many as he could. He was such an infectious character. And in the end, he landed up being the chief librarian. I mean, that became a title that they gave to him, which I think was self-christened initially. And then people thought, well, he is virtually running the place, which he was.
And he was, again, such a compelling character. I loved that story. And I think you said he sort of charmed his way because of his enthusiasm into sort of helping run the library. Is that right?
Yes, yes. He would be the one. He said, I'd position my desk. I've got it right in the middle of the library. That's not my main office, but my other desk, where he said, I am there so when people come in, they see me. And when they want to borrow a book, just like in one of our libraries, of course, you have to give your name and you have to sign in for taking it and give your address. And he said, I make sure all that has gone through, but also sometimes people like to talk about the books, you know, so I've read a lot of them now, so I will tell them what this book's about or that book's about. One thing that also amused me greatly was I'd asked some of the people running the library, that's in addition to Amjad, what sort of books do you have? Do you have censorship in here? Do you allow books, for instance, on sexual matters? And I was told that, yes, they do have. They have what they call explicit books in the library, which I was told were for married couples or people who are engaged. And they said, but there again, you see, no one can borrow these unless they ask a member of staff to get them for them. And we keep them on the top shelf. And of course, this little Amjad, who was quite short, as well as just being 14. And I thought, what on earth would happen if someone asked him to get one down for them?
And Mike, I wish this story had a happy ending, but tell us how long the library was able to stay there and what happened.
Well, everyone was evacuated in August 2016 when the town finally surrendered after 4 years of battling the Assad regime, and people were evacuated to different parts of the country, mainly to Idlib, which is still, of course, being bombed and shelled, at least until the current ceasefire. And the library was left behind, which was just traumatic for everyone there. And no one knew what would happen to it. And I'm not sure this is perhaps the place you'd like me to read to you a quote from Abdul Basit about that time before they left, when he was having to turn his back for the last time on the books.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful. Please do.
Abdul Basit told me, "When I tell you what I did next, this is on the last day before they had to flee the town. When I tell you what I did next, please don't think I'm crazy or shell-shocked or something, but this is what happened. Knowing that this might be the last time I would ever see the library, I walked over to the shelves and hugged the books. I hugged as many as I could. While I did this, I cried. I cried a lot. Then I walked around reading the titles on the spines out loud and flicking through the pages of some of them. I so wished I could take all the books with me, all of them. I feared they'd be burned or destroyed in some other way, and I'm sure this will happen. It would be so terrible. I believe in the books, and I believe in our secret library." And that's what he told me on the last day. And of course, the future wasn't good, as you said, not a rosy future for the library, because after the after everyone left, I was desperately trying to get in to Drea to find out what had happened to the library. And in the end, I wasn't given a visa by the Syrian authorities, but a CNN crew was. And they had heard the radio documentary you played a little of just now and had gone to Drea to see if they could find out what had happened to the library. And they were really helpful with me. I rang them up and they told me all about how they'd been told roughly where it was, and then they'd driven around and tried to recognise the description of where they were told it was from the description from the landmarks they'd been given. But of course most had been bombed and destroyed, so it was very hard. But in the end they managed to find a place where some soldiers were emerging with boxes of books in their hands and loading them onto a pickup truck. And those they discovered when they went downstairs were from the secret library. This was the very place.
We're speaking with Mike Thompson. He was just reading a section from his book, Syria's Secret Library, Reading and Redemption in a Town Under Siege, telling us the story about the young Syrians who risked their lives for their love of books. More in a moment. I'm Sarah McCammon. You're listening to 1A.
The biggest story in the world is a science story. And keeping up with all the latest coronavirus research, it's a lot. So on Shortwave, we translate the science you need to know into short daily episodes. Listen and subscribe to Shortwave from NPR.
This is 1A. We're speaking with Mike Thompson, author of Syria's Secret Library. Mike, you described the crew there, a CNN crew that went back and tried to find out what happened to the books after the library was sort of shut down, was overrun. Do you know where the soldiers were taking those books?
Well, it seems what was going to happen is that they were being taken off to be sold, because each book was given by the people around the library. They put in the name of the house that the book was found in, the name of the owners, and then they put a special serial number. And the idea had been so that when the war was over, if it went their way at least, they would be able to return all these books, which they said to me were only ever loaned to us. They were never our books. We would give them back. And a lot of these books were discovered for sale in the markets of Damascus. And of course, they contained all the details I mentioned to you, the special codes as well as the addresses. So there was no doubt at all where these books had come from.
And I know you kept in touch with some of the people from the library. Who do you still talk to? How are they doing?
I still talk to most of them, to be honest, Sarah. To get the book together, and indeed from my initial time of talking to them, it's been sort of 4 years now, I think. So I've often had little texts from them telling me this, that, the other, often quite personal things, like if they've had a baby or someone's got married or whatever. And sometimes, too, when it's been particularly frightening in Idlib, where they're being bombed, that's in the northwest of Syria, occasionally I'll get messages from people talking about the situation there. A couple of women, because this was also a library for women, who were behind all this, and talking about their hopes and fears. Some of them have made it out to Turkey, but of course the border is shut, so most people can't get out. Abdul Basit and Anas are still in Idlib city, and both seem determined to stay, come what may. They've also managed to buy a few books, and this, and in fact, Abdul Basit still dreams of returning to Dereya and rebuilding the library, and I hope he does it. And in fact, I think he probably will. Whenever one day they can go home.
Yeah, you talk about people wanting to go home and continuing on with their lives, having children, that sort of thing. I mean, to what extent have the people you met in Dereya been able to go on and sort of live normal lives? And to what extent are their lives still disrupted?
Well, they're still terribly disrupted because nobody has been able to go back to Dereya, none of the people that I spoke to. And when I last heard from the place, it was still comparatively deserted and only people being settled there that the government wanted. So for those people still in Idlib, still in northwest Syria, that's people like Abdul Basit, Anas, and a woman called Sarah, it is very, very difficult. They have to deal not only with the ongoing bombing, a respite recently because of the ceasefire that was announced in early March, but nonetheless the threat that Assad's forces will retake the whole of the country. And the difficulty in affording, being able to buy any food, having any money to buy any food. So it's a very worrying future for them. But one of the most remarkable things about all of them has been the way I never hear them feeling sorry for themselves, which they've every right to do, given what they've experienced and what they're still experiencing. It's a sort of positivity about life and the feeling that, like they said about Assad, but no tyrant ever lasts. They always go in the end. It's only a matter of time. And it's only a matter of time, they said, before we can go home again. And that was said by people both in northwest Syria and also those who had made it through to Turkey. This enormous, and one of the things from the whole book that I found so extraordinary was just how inspiring these people are. Their whole attitude, the humanity that's left in them, the sort of politeness, the one guy even managed to apologise to me for being half an hour late for an interview for my book.
Because
he said my street was being bombed. I thought I better wait.
It certainly puts our current challenges in perspective, doesn't it, Mike?
It does. It certainly does.
I've been talking with Mike Thompson, author of Syria's Secret Library, Reading and Redemption in a Town Under Siege. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
My absolute pleasure.
And before we go, for weeks now, we've been making time at the end of every show for your acts of kindness. Today's story comes from Teresa in rural Florida.
I manage an adult ed program in a poor rural community. And a very close friend asked if through my work I know of anyone in need, especially in this time of COVID-19, because she wants to donate half of her stimulus check and doesn't want to go through an agency. This is a friend who grew up in the projects, was a single mom forever, works full time, and she's insisting on absolute anonymity. So this week, I'll share the good news and the cash with one of my students, a man in his 30s who is working on his GED, doing tough outdoor labor for $10 an hour with no benefits, and a sick wife at home who can't get disability. And I can't wait to see his face this week. I only wish I could connect him with my friend because I know they would become fast friends.
This conversation was produced by Haley Blassingame and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Sarah McCammon. Thanks so much for listening. This is 1A.